Hello, and welcome to Few and Far Between, Conversations about Rare Disease Research. I am your host, Wayne Bowden. So on this episode, we have our own Becky Nakamist as a guest host. Becky is the Vice President of Program Development here at BioRassi, and she's going to be talking with Dawn Blessing from Zogenix and Mike Graglia from SynGap Research Fund. So a little bit about Becky first. Becky has built a stellar reputation leading sales and business development teams within the life sciences industry. Most recently, before joining the BioRassi team in the middle of a global pandemic, she was SVP of Data and Analytics Sales at Decision Resources Group, which is now part of Clarivate. And they're a commercialization consulting firm serving biopharma, medtech, and healthcare. Now, Becky successfully runs our program development and sales team here at BioRassi. She's already proven herself worthy of the challenge, leading and helping to grow and level up our sales and sales teams. First, thanks for hosting this episode, Becky. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about your conversation with Dawn and Mike?
Hi, Wayne. Wow, what an introduction. So thank you for all of that. And I wanted to thank you because I really appreciated the opportunity to host this podcast. It was such a pleasure speaking with Dawn and Mike, and I learned so much from both of them. I think our audience is really going to enjoy this episode, but I want to give you a little bit of insight about our discussion. So Dawn is the VP of Scientific Strategy and Corporate Development at Zogenix, as you mentioned. Zogenix, for our listeners, is a U.S.-based pharmaceutical company dedicated to developing and commercializing rare disease therapeutics. She has spent her career in drug development with a focus on rare disease, and she also serves on the board of directors of CureGM1 Foundation and on the scientific advisory board of Tess Research Foundation, so she's a very busy woman. Mike is the founder and managing director of the SynGap Research Fund. He also has a weekly podcast that is focused on rare disease and most specifically SynGap1. He has a son who was diagnosed with SynGap1, which is a neurological disorder with multiple symptoms that include epilepsy and autism. The struggles with obtaining information and finding others with this rare disease led to the creation of the SynGap Research Fund. So our conversation focused on foundations and the work that they do not only to fund research, but to support parents, family members, and patients diagnosed and impacted by rare disease. Mike outlined some of his own struggles as a parent watching his four-year-old son endure a battery of tests, and he now spends his time counseling and helping others understand the diagnosis and what can be done. Dawn spent some time explaining the impact of these very important foundations on drug development. By helping identify patients, these foundations provide data and information crucial to researchers, and they help build networks of patients and sites ready to go should a drug get to the clinical trial stage. It was a fascinating discussion, and I hope our listeners enjoyed as much as I did.
Thanks, Becky. For me, actually, this was one of my favorite episodes. I think having the two speakers, you know, at kind of on one on the pharma side and then one on the, you know, patient advocacy side was just a good mix. And then, you know, you did an excellent job hosting. So I think the listeners will really enjoy it. So without further delay, let's let them do so and get into your discussion with Mike and Dawn right now.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us today for another episode in our continuing conversations about rare disease research. Today, I have two guests joining me, and I feel very fortunate to have that. First, I have Dawn Blessing, who is the Vice President of Scientific Strategy and Corporate Development at Zogenix, which is a U.S.-based pharmaceutical company dedicated to the development and commercialization of therapeutics for rare disease. And she's also serves on the board of directors at CureGM1 Foundation, which is focused on research for GM1 gangliosidosis. And she serves on the scientific advisory board on Tess Research Foundation, which is also dedicated to finding a treatment for the genetic disease SLC135A deficiency. So welcome, Dawn. We're so glad to have you today.
Hi.
And then also, I'm very honored to have Mike Graglia, who is the founder and managing director of the SynGap Research Fund. Mike also has a weekly podcast that is focused on rare disease and most specifically SynGap1. So, Mike, it is a pleasure to have you with us here today as well.
Thank you very much.
Dawn, I thought I would start with you. If you could tell us a little more about your background. I just gave a couple of highlights. I know that you have worked with other companies in drug development with a focus on rare disease. You serve on two of these foundations. So can you tell us a little more about your background and how you got into the rare disease space?
Yeah, sure. So I actually started out in finance and equity research covering biotechnology and then went to business school. And after business school, I transitioned into biotech. At the time, I didn't realize that I was entering the world of rare disease as a committed endeavor. But my role, I was hired at a company called BioMarin Pharmaceutical, which is one of the sort of leading rare disease therapeutic development companies. And after joining BioMarin and being exposed to rare disease drug development and all of the patients that are affected by these disorders and the families, I fell in love with it. Like so many people who first get exposed to rare disease, they become committed. So I stayed at BioMarin for many years and then transitioned on to a genetic company, 23andMe, which many people have probably heard of from their consumer business. And then also was spent some time at a rare disease gene therapy company called Audentes Therapeutics, and then was at Modus Therapeutics, which was founded and led by some former BioMarin colleagues, all rare disease therapeutic companies. And now, as you mentioned, I am at Zogenix. So that's my background and how I came to rare disease.
You've certainly covered a lot of companies, and I think it's probably been pretty fascinating watching or going through all of this. Mm-hmm. Tell me how you got involved with the Cure GM1 Foundation and Tess Research. What was the pioneering idea for these foundations, and how did you hear about them? How did you learn, and what role do you play exactly?
Sure. So my role in industry is primarily in corporate development, so identifying new opportunities for the companies for whom I work to advance therapeutics. And as such, I follow the research and what the new technology is in various different spaces. And as Mike will speak to, the Rare Disease Patient Foundations are extremely sophisticated in enabling therapeutic development. And through my search for new therapies for the companies that I've been working for, I've encountered many patient foundations. So Cure GM1, both Cure GM1 and the Tess Research Foundation were both founded by fierce parents of ultra-rare genetic diseases. And they were both founded with a similar goal of facilitating and making more efficient and faster therapeutic development for their diseases. So they have individually raised several million dollars to fund research, and their focus is on research. Some patient advocacy groups are more focused on supporting the families, and some are more focused on research. Some do a little bit of everything, but Cure GM1 and Tess are highly focused on supporting research to develop therapeutics for their disease.
Thank you. Mike, I'm now going to turn it over a bit to you and put you on the hot seat for a moment. So can you tell us a little bit about your background? Because like Dawn, it doesn't sound like you were starting in any kind of clinical field and actually had some personal experience that led you to starting this SynGap Research Fund. I believe it's been in operation now a few years. Can you tell me about how that started, what led you to where you are today, and what plans you have for SynGap Research?
Sure. It's a tall order. yeah. I mean, you're exactly right. Before SRF, I was not even vaguely thinking about it. But my wacky career prior to my son being diagnosed with this disease, and that's what led to SRF, in a sense, prepared me for this work. So I was a math major, mainly because I'm hopelessly dyslexic. Like, I can't spell any of the words I'm using these days. They're all very long. And I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I taught math. I went off to business school, like Dawn. And then I was a management consultant and ended up in healthcare on the business side. And that led to actually working for and then joining the Gates Foundation, where I did a lot of finance and strategy. And really, finance and strategy is what rare disease groups have to figure out to get right. There are a few other steps in there, but basically, my son was clearly a bit delayed in the first couple of years. At the age of 3, he was diagnosed with epilepsy. That led to genetic testing, and he received a SynGap diagnosis at the age of 4. That was 3.5 years ago. my wife and I did the rounds. We talked to everybody who would talk to us, and we came to a few conclusions. One of them was that science was moving really fast and there was hope. There was reason to believe we could go to the root cause, which was a deficiency in the SYNGAP protein in the brain. And there really wasn't a patient advocacy group, as Don said, focused on the research, right? Committed to raising funds, committed to moving the needle on science, and committed to bringing people in. And we said, well, let's do it. Let's raise some money. And it was how naive I was back then, right? So I kept my day job. At that point, I was doing finance for a small foundation. And I thought I would just start SRF and run it in my spare time and raise some money and pay for some postdocs. That's how dumb I was. And very quickly, I realized that this bifurcation between driving science and supporting and engaging the patient community is a bit, in my mind, is a bit artificial, right? Some groups only support patients, and that's fine. But if you're going to drive science, you have to engage patients because you need their data, you need their samples, you need their engagement. And so SRF has broadened its focus, and a lot of patients were really energized by science. It's hopeful. It's hopeful to say to people, there's hope, there's things happening. The future can be different if we do X, Y, and Z. And people were really attracted to that. And so about a year and a half ago, I was just exhausted. I was sort of doing a day job. I'm surprised they didn't fire me, to be honest with you. It was so much going on. And I was working all night long on SRF, and I just said, I can't do it anymore. And we're fortunate, you know, my wife can carry us. And so I said, I'm done. I'm just going to do SRF full time as a volunteer. And that's what I've been doing for the past year and a half. I think I answered your question. I just want to add, even though we haven't been smart enough and I haven't made the time to put Don and a few other people I talk to regularly on my SAB, Don helps a lot more groups than Tess and GM1. She's a valuable resource, and she's very generous with her time and her wisdom. SRF has definitely benefited from her kindness.
That is great to hear. I'm glad you're talking about hope, because I think that's something that, especially as a parent or even a patient with a rare disease, some of these, I think I read SYNGAP, there's 650 cases globally. So it's very easy to feel lost in a system and hopeless and alone, and that there's no, you know, there's nowhere to go. So I like that you're bringing up hope and the benefit of a community for people that are either suffering or parents of children that have this disease. So let me ask you, how do you find other families when something is this rare? When your son was diagnosed, was there a network for you? Did you have a place to go, or did you have to build your own?
Yes, all of the above. So, yes. So a few things. I mean, there was one Facebook group that was not terribly supportive, but you know, that was all that was in town. So that's what we did. What I observed, to come back to that number you threw out, was that when I was first diagnosed, I said, how many people have this disease? And the answer was 1 to 200. And then a year later, somebody said, how many people have this disease? 1 to 200. And I was like, that's dumb, because I've seen one patient a week show up for the past year. So the answer should be at least 150 to 250. So the answer to your question is, how do we find them as we collaborate? There are small groups of parents in different countries, right? So I reached out to all those parents who lead Germany, Spain, France, Canada, all these places. And I said, how many do you know about in your country? How many are you sure about in your country? And I put out a blog 2 years ago, and I said, I have counted 364 families. And this is when people were saying 1 to 200. And I said, the only thing I'm sure about is this number is low. And since then, every quarter, SRF, in partnership with other SYNGAP organizations around the planet, have updated that number. And so the number you quoted was one of my old blogs.
Ah, okay.
But we update that every quarter. So just at the beginning of this month, July, we put out a new number, and it's 808. 220 in the US, 110 in the UK, you know, double digits in other major countries, and then a lot of others. And so the answer to your question is, how do we find patients? We work on every front, because it is terribly lonely. It's heartbreaking. Generally, you know, doctors and genetic counselors in this space are hopelessly overworked. So they Google something, they give something to a patient, they move on. The patient is left with Dr. Google, which is generally heartbreaking and outdated, frankly. And so what we do is we reached out to all the genetics companies and said, please make sure you mention us in your diagnosis. And you'd be surprised that that's not as easy as you would think. And then we also now we run Google ads. And when someone types SYNGAP, the first thing you should find is our organization. And we have people not just in the SYNGAP groups, but we have people in the absence autism groups. We have people in the absence seizure group, the autism group, the whatever. If some kid somewhere, it looks like a SYNGAPian, and the mom is saying, what's going on with my kid? And we're like, get genetic testing. And if someone in one of these broader groups says, my kid just got SYNGAP1, we pull them in. So it's really, you know, when I started this, I thought I was building a speedboat to race across the ocean to a cure. No one knows what the cure is, so that was silly. And now the way I think about our work, and I think it's a better analogy, is I'm building a lighthouse, right? And I'm trying to just send out as much light as possible so that the families find us, and so the researchers find us, and so companies like Zogenix find us. And so when you get the academics and the companies and the families and the physicians all together talking about SYNGAP1, then I've done my job, because then the way forward is clear. But you're exactly right. The finding the families and the pulling them in and the telling them what's going on, that is a huge amount of work. And that's why I do that podcast. It's just one more way that someone can start typing SYNGAP1 and hopefully they'll find us.
It is amazing that you are doing this piece by piece, building the lighthouse, as you say, and you're finding more. I mean, you start with one in 200 and now you've found 808 cases. So that's a real testament to all the work you're doing. Dawn, has that been your experience with the GM1 Foundation and Tess Research Foundation? How do they go about finding families and letting people know that there is support out there, there's hope out there?
Yeah, it's very similar. Thank goodness we have social media in 2021.
Right.
Because that's obviously an incredibly leverageable platform to reach almost anybody. And there's all the same types of outreach in terms of newsletters, Facebook pages, LinkedIn, you know, anything you can imagine, as well as, you know, being very receptive to newly diagnosed families. So one of the things that both foundations, Tess Research and Cure GM1 offer is when a family is diagnosed and they reach out to the foundation, we're able to offer them support in whatever ways they might need in terms of which are the best physicians, which are the key opinion leaders in the space, what to expect. So yeah, it's quite similar to the outreach and the support that SYNGAP does.
So you talked a little bit, both of you have mentioned the diagnosis, and Mike, you said that your son was originally diagnosed with epilepsy. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the challenges in general with rare disease, because I hear about, you know, either diagnoses that aren't quite right or misdiagnoses. Mike, I'll start with you. I think they did a genetic test, but was there a reason you went beyond the epilepsy diagnosis? Was there something that was creating concern? And then Dawn, I'd like to ask the same question. I mean, is diagnosing these diseases still a real challenge for us? Are we making headway? Or I'd like your thoughts in general. But Mike, let's start with you and the journey you and your family took.
Three things. One, I'll talk about my journey. Two, I'll assert the system is hopelessly broken. And three, I'll say we are doing better. My journey was, our kids present like Fragile X, and Fragile X has done a great job of raising awareness. And the way you test for Fragile X is a chromosomal microarray. The trouble is that won't catch SYNGAP1. So pretty much all of our families get tested for Fragile X, and some people come back and say, oh, it's not genetic. These people need more training, if I'm polite. We were seeing two neurologists at once when my son was first diagnosed with epilepsy, because my wife's really an overachiever. And luckily, one of them literally did a chromosomal microarray and was like, you're not genetic. And that was clearly the wrong answer. And we went to the other one. And the next step is to do an epilepsy panel. And we did the epilepsy panel with Invitae, and that came back with a variant of uncertain significance on SYNGAP1. And that's another place a lot of people fall through the cracks. Because of us, some people choose not to pursue of us. They think it's a maybe, you don't want to worry the parents, we don't know enough yet, we'll come back. Thank God we had an incredible genetic counselor. I think genetic counselors are the unsung heroes of this space. And she said, I've read about SYNGAP. I've looked at this VUS. I think there's more here. And she came to me and she said, the only way we resolve this VUS, because it was intronic, is to do RNA sequencing to see if this intronic mutation was affecting protein or RNA expression. And I was so fed up. I mean, I'd had so many tests and so many EGs and so many hospital visits. And I was like, and she just said, look, I know you don't want to hear that, but she said, please do it. And thank God for Ellie Brimble, because that RNA test confirmed that Tony had SYNGAP1. And, you know, we are very, very blessed. We live in the shadow of Stanford University. We had one of the best genetic counselors in the country. And, you know, I had to get past a neurologist from another institution saying it wasn't genetic. I had to have her push me to do a VUS, and I had to get over my own exhaustion as a parent of a sick kid. And now that I lead SRF and I'm on the phone with a newly diagnosed family at least once a week, at least once a week now, I'm on the phone with somebody, whether they're in Texas or Michigan or Ireland or Hong Kong, if I just think about the past month, right? I'm on the phone with a new family. And I hear their stories, and it's bananas, right? People with VUSs have waited for years for that VUS to be classified. People have literally had to accidentally followed up with a neurology office because someone had a seizure and they said, oh yeah, your genetic testing results are here. But the person who ordered the test quit, so no one knew what to do with it. Oh, looks like you've got, I mean, it's ridiculous. How many people have waited how long to get a test. And those are just the ones who got a diagnosis, because those are the ones I know. God only knows, if you'll forgive the expression, how many people are still undiagnosed or stuck in that system or did a CMA and think they're done. So that's where I get to. I really feel the system is broken. I think there's a too small but growing cadre of clinicians who understand how critically important this is and how this can change the current. This can change. So why does a diagnosis matter? Today, your parent goes from feeling alone and frustrated and like their kid is uniquely weird to suddenly finding their tribe. You know, tomorrow it affects how that kid is treated. We know what drugs do well. We know what drugs don't do well. We know a lot that we can do with today's tools, albeit acknowledging today's AEDs are not great. And in the narrative future, because of the hard work of people like Dawn and her colleagues, we can go to the source and we can upregulate expression, right? So the genetic diagnosis is so important. And I haven't even mentioned that insurance likes to say no. So getting people through this system is essential. And I do think we're doing better. Doing better because the costs are coming down. We're doing better because the epilepsy panels are including. And by the way, SYNGAP is no longer just on an epilepsy panel. We're now on an autism panel. We're on a cerebral palsy panel. We're on a number of panel or ID panels. So as we get this gene on more panels and more people realize genetic testing is essential and the cost makes it more accessible, we are going to have more kids. But 808 is a drop in the bucket. There are thousands. The incidence data is 6 in 100,000 births, right? Or conceptions, I should say. There's a lot of SYNGAPians out there we still need to find. I'm sorry if I talk too much.
Oh, no, no. That's why we're here.
Okay, well, I'm just getting going.
You can keep going. I'm not going to stop you.
I think that was my answer. I think I answered the question. I don't know anymore.
You did. You did. You answered beautifully. And no, and you made some really good points. Especially bringing in the insurance companies, because I know expense can be a daunting thing as well as feeling alone and hopeless and frustrated. So there's a lot.
Well, just to double click on this, the insurance companies are shooting themselves in the foot, right? These kids who are undiagnosed are getting hundreds of hours of therapy, countless tests. My son, I've met kids who've had MRIs, spinal taps. I do not know what a spinal tap costs, but it costs more than $250.
Yes.
And the Invitae Epilepsy Panel is private pay is $250. So dear insurance companies, approve these tests. You will save yourself a lot of money. It is such a no-brainer. Forget the human misery you're avoiding by helping parents find the right care. It makes financial sense.
No argument here. I no argument from me. Dawn, do you have any comment? I mean, you've had a career in drug development for rare disease. Has this any comments you want to make on the diagnosis? Do you think we're getting better? I know times have changed over the last years. I think we're seeing fewer misdiagnoses, but there's also this lack of education around some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, the average time to diagnosis for a rare disease is anywhere from 5 to 7 years, which is unfortunate on many fronts, not to mention the fact that once therapeutics become available, treating earlier is always better. So that delay is time lost in preventing disease progression. I mean, for me, what I think is most important is the cost of genetic testing that makes it accessible today. I mean, as Mike said, I have not had to deal with getting it reimbursed from insurance companies, but we know that it is so much cheaper than it was 15, 20 years ago. 30 years ago, I mean, there were diseases that were diagnosed based on a biopsy, and now we can determine genetically, not only what the cause of the disease is, but knowing the specific mutation can also be very important in determining prognosis and potentially treatment. So I'm grateful that genetic testing is available today in a way that it wasn't 20 years ago. But the time delay to diagnosis is still extremely frustrating.
So I wanted to also, we've talked about the foundations in diagnosis and treatment, but in a lot of times, I think frustrated parents are also, as they are looking for treatments for their children and they're doing the research, why can't we move faster? And a lot of times it's because of the components involved in developing a therapeutic in a rare disease. This is something you've spent your career in drug development. So can you talk about the components that go into developing a therapeutic in a rare disease and why at times it is difficult and we don't move as rapidly as we'd like?
Yeah.
I know that's a big question.
Drug development is hard, period. Drug development in rare disease is easier in some ways, I put in quotes, because of legislation that exists, like the Orphan Drug Act. but it's also more challenging in ways because of the scarcity of patients and understanding of these diseases. So some diseases, rare diseases that are pretty well understood these days, like, for example, Duchenne muscular dystrophy, benefit from all of the data that has been generated in them. In some newer rare diseases, like SYNGAP, for example, there doesn't exist a data set, a clinical human data set, by which we can refer to determine whether or not a therapeutic is working. It's very complex, finding the patients to enroll in the clinical study. And this is all the challenges I'm talking about are once you've actually identified a potential therapeutic.
Right.
Thank goodness, you know, again, getting back to science, gene therapy now has enabled development opportunities for rare diseases that 20 years ago, the only option were small molecules, if you could identify one that impacted the protein of interest, or potentially protein therapy, but often that wasn't the case. And so gene therapy is changing the landscape for a lot of rare diseases.
Let's talk a bit. I'm pausing because I wanted to ask you, I know there's been a CRISPR-based clinical trial that has had some, that has been very successful. That's a gene therapy technology that has made great strides. I didn't know if you had any comments about that, but it fits in some of the amazing things we're seeing with gene therapy. I think there's still a challenge though with some of these enzyme therapies from blood to brain, but do you have any comments? Do you think there's hope on the horizon, more hope? Do you think this offers a real chance for a lot of people suffering with rare disease?
Yeah, so there are different flavors of gene therapy. My experience has primarily been within the AAV gene replacement, where you simply, again, in quotes, replace the cDNA that's deficient in the patient by delivering it with a virus that's not harmful. CRISPR is a gene editing approach. And you mentioned protein therapy and lack of access to the brain. We're now, you know, for several diseases, including BioMarin's Batten's disease drug Brineura, they're actually delivering the protein intrathecally right into the base of the neck. Those are frequent injections into the CSF, but it works. And the data from Brineura was pretty astounding. I mean, it's an awful, awful disease. So, you know, it all comes back, at least for me, to advances in research, science, and technology that enable protein delivery that once could only be delivered intravenously can now be delivered into the CSF. CRISPR, you know, my background is in gene replacement. And when I was at Audentes, for example, and we were doing gene replacement, CRISPR was way earlier. And now, as you mentioned, it's in the clinic, which is amazing.
Yes.
So kudos to the academicians that push all of this forward, that enable us in development to actually treat patients.
But again, it goes back to something we talked about earlier, which is finding those patients and identifying those patients. To Mike's point, there are still thousands of undiagnosed SYNGAP patients out there. And that is one of the biggest challenges we face, of course, in clinical trials is recruiting patients, finding them. Where are they? And many times we're often tapping the same providers and the same sites for trials over and over again. And you really want to broaden, but it's difficult. So you've mentioned that social media has made it easier to communicate, easier to form networks and groups. But any other suggestions or thoughts on how to recruit patients, find patients, build these networks outside of, I mean, each foundation you're
Mike's
having
chomping
to dedicate.
At the bit. Mike. Let's start with him.
Perfect. Let's go, Mike.
I'm
Tell
going
me your
nuts
thoughts.
Over here. So like I said, in the beginning, I just wanted to raise money and pay for postdocs, which was naive in a couple of regards. One, I was missing the patient component. Two, I would actually now advocate more strongly for funding CROs to make assets than I would for funding postdocs. And you're not paying me to say that. You fund a postdoc, takes a long time. You may or may not have been smart enough to negotiate for rights to what's created. And it's expensive. And if you know you need mice and cell lines, go to a CRO and get it done. But on the patient part, in addition to funding science, and I'm proud to say we've committed over $1.5 million to various projects so far, and I've got another $500,000 sitting on my desk right now that I need to raise money for.
Fantastic.
But in addition to that, what I have also prioritized is clinical trial readiness. Because while it is hard and expensive for CROs and companies to find patients and collect natural history, that is exactly what every patient advocacy group should be doing. We should be, this is why I publish the SYNGAP census every quarter. And I'm telling you, there's 808. In 2.5 months, I'll be like, guess what? There's, I don't know, 900. That's because I want you to know they're out there and I want you to know that I know where they are so we can find them when you're ready, number one. Number two, it's not sufficient for me to say there's 200 people in the US, because that just could be, I've got 200 people in my Facebook group. And some of those people are SYNGAP patients like mine. And some of those people have a VUS on a genetic report and they think they're SYNGAP patients, but they're not. And some of those people self-diagnosed off of a Google post and their kid doesn't have any genetic disease. And so in addition to giving you a list of names and locations or helping you connect in a privacy protected appropriate way, patients, I think it's incumbent on me as a rare disease group to know that these people are actually have a confirmed genetic diagnosis. So one of the things that we've spent a staggering amount of time and money on, more time than money, is partnering with a group called Citizen, who's also not paying me to say this, but they do a medical records-based natural history study, digital natural history study. So basically, we sign up with them. They collect all the medical records in the US in a HIPAA-compliant manner, and they standardize and normalize them, and that data is freely available to researchers and licensable by companies. And that is amazing, because those people have all been reviewed by the genetic counselors at Citizen. Every single of the 110 SYNGAP patients in that natural history study right now have a confirmed genetic diagnosis. So you don't have to waste time, spend time and money finding patients. I got 110 lined up, consented, ready to go. Let's do this. Because what's heartbreaking to me is when I look at other disease groups that are ahead of us, you know, scientists have toiled away. We finally have a way to deliver an ASO to kids with Dravet, for instance. And then they look at the data and they're like, this isn't very good. And they spend a year that they could have spent running a trial, running another natural, it's bananas. And so that's my worst nightmare. Like, my son is 7. You know, he's going to keep getting bigger and stronger and older and sicker. And when someone's finally ready to use some CRISPR-based ASO, AAV, pick your favorite three letters here, yeah, I want SYNGAP to be ready to go. And that's why we're doing the natural history study. And that's why we're investing in biomarker work and other analysis, because time is brain and our kids' brains are being built badly right now. So I think my answer to your question is, whenever you, Becky, or Don, or anyone talks to a rare disease group, be like, how many patients do you have? Are they ready? Are they in a study? Have you seen the genetic reports? Like, get your team ready. Don't just sit there and wait for someone to call you.
That's a great message for patient advocacy groups. Don, Mike seems ahead of the game. Are you finding that more foundations, more groups are actually lining up patients that are ready to go when the time is here?
Yeah, I would say any foundation that has a potential therapeutic on the horizon and has interactions with industry understands the importance of patient identification and are highly focused on it, and also recognize the value that the foundation brings to industry having identified these patients. So, you know, drug development and rare disease could not happen without these foundations, both in terms of some of the research that they fund, whether it's animal models or genotype-phenotype correlations. But patient identification it's something that I think most rare disease foundations that, again, is if there's a therapeutic on the horizon, they know it needs to be done. The other thing that I was going to mention is, you know, coming up with campaigns, strategic, intelligent campaigns that can help take a pool of patients presenting with a particular phenotype and then deposit them into their genetic diagnosis is what we need. And one that's been very successful is called Beyond the Seizure. It's supported by Invitae, which is a genetic testing company, but it's a collaboration among several rare disease companies because there are so many rare diseases that first present with seizure. And so this campaign has sort of highlighted to docs who may just see a kid who gets a seizure once and then not again, or once and then not for another year and a half, to say, if you see a seizure, get them tested on this panel. So, I think we're moving in the right direction.
I always like to hear we're moving in the right direction. That's good. That's a good sign. Speaking of moving in the right direction, we've talked a bit about, you know, the advances that we've made from 15 years ago, 10 years ago. And I'm seeing, you know, again, in the CRO world, we're seeing more focus on rare disease. That's been something, you know, we're seeing smaller trials that are really laser focused in a certain area. Are you in the industry seeing a greater focus on rare disease? Would you say that is, I don't know if it's social media, there's more buzz around it, or what are your thoughts around that? And that goes to both of you, I think.
Yeah, I can start. So rare disease companies are more prevalent today than they are 20 years ago because of the success of the rare disease companies that were launched 20, 25 years ago. You know, I referred earlier to the Orphan Drug Act, which enabled companies that are required, if they want to continue to be an ongoing entity, to provide a return to the investors that gave them money at some point to make money, right? And so the Orphan Drug Act enabled that for these diseases that were orphaned previously because they were believed you couldn't, you know, generate any sort of profit in that business. Fortunately, that's changed today. And now there's so many, I think there's 400 plus therapeutics that have been approved for rare disease. And it's business model that sprouted out of the legislation that has enabled this to happen. And I believe it's going to continue to happen. And is, you know, and again, you know, coming back to the technology, there's all the different components. There's the legislative aspect, there's the business financial aspect, and then there's the science and technology. And bringing that together is what has enabled the industry to really thrive.
Mike, any thoughts on the industry, rare disease in general, and what you've seen with SynGap since you've started your fund?
Yeah, I think there's two thoughts. It's hard to go after Dawn because she's so smart. She covers everything. I will make two points, though. One of them is rare diseases aren't that rare. We're just underdiagnosed, right? So there's a huge market waiting to be explored. That's what behind the seizure is, right? We go out, we make a cure for Dravet, and then we start to, oh my God, there's a lot of Dravet kids, a lot of SynGap, Wonka, whatever. So the total addressable market here is massive. We just have to find it. And the trends are such that we will find more and more patients faster and faster. It's going to be a hockey stick. By the way, we only test kids for genetic diseases. But if you look at the data, cohort study after cohort study, somewhere between 1 in 200 and 1 in 100 people, adults with ID and epilepsy sitting in homes, have SynGap 1. The market's massive. So that's one. It's smart business to go into rare because there's untapped markets that people are ignoring. Point two, and I hate to say this about my own son, our children are natural experiments that you couldn't perform ethically, right? Do you want to understand learning and memory? Do you want to understand perseveration and autism? Do you want to know how to make people smarter and help them with challenging behaviors? I have 808 patients around the world who are natural experiments in what happens when you mess with SynGap 1. And you couldn't ethically do that to a human, but nature's done it for us. So let's learn as much as we can and help as many as we can. I think smart scientists and smart business people should be running to the fire with rare disease. They should be just jumping in because there is so much opportunity here to benefit your shareholders and develop benefit humanity. The science is awesome and the money is there.
That segues into a great question. So what changes do we need to make to truly tap into this? And where do we go from here? And that's to Mike or Dawn or whoever would like to.
We should let the smart one go first.
I guess my first thought is not so much of what changes can we make, but what we need to continue to protect. Speaking from the perspective of industry, is we need to protect the ability to develop therapeutics for diseases that impact 1,000, 2,000 or fewer hundreds of patients. I don't want to get into the morass of drug pricing, but you know, one thing that really frustrates me as someone who works in drug development, and particularly in drug development for devastating diseases from which children die, is we talk about drug price. We don't talk about drug value. There is so much tremendous value that is brought to these patients through all of the research and development. And as I said at the very beginning of this podcast, drug development is hard. And after 10, 15 years of research, development, time, money, resources, CEOs going out and pounding the pavement to try and raise money so they can develop these therapeutics. And then finally, you know, we have a drug like Brineura for Batten's disease that dramatically changes patients' lives. And I'd like us to kind of manage the communication better and talk about value rather than price. So that's kind of my thoughts.
I, again, couldn't agree more. I think that is definitely, we have to change the conversation. There's no doubt. Mike, what do you think? Any changes, or what do we need to protect, and where do we go from here?
Yeah, there's a lot we can change. Step one, I think everybody, and I include the doctors in this, need to get their head wrapped around the speed of change. When my wife and I started SRF, we were talking to some of the smartest people in America, and what we were led to believe would happen in the next 3 years happened in the next year, right? And maybe they were keeping our expectations low, but I really think everybody's a little bit gobsmacked at how quickly things are happening. And so to me, it is somewhere between wrong and unethical, if not both, for a doctor to look at a patient and say, yep, here's your kid's disease. Sorry, there's no treatment. They're going to be disabled for life. It could be true, but it's probably wrong, right? And when a parent is told that every cell in their child's body has a typo and they're sick because of it and there's no hope and no cure, that's not great for the parent. I'm the one who picks them up off the floor and has to talk to them for 3 hours. So I wish the doctors would say, yeah, but this is a blessing. This diagnosis, like, first of all, you know, many people don't. Second of all, there's a lot of good people working hard on a therapy. Third of all, here's SYNGAP Research Fund. Go talk to them and get support from other parents who've lived through what you currently think you can't live through, right? So what we need to change is the clinical interaction around a genetic diagnosis. It's not a death sentence. It's a window. It's a doorway to a place of hope where things are changing. And I cannot tell you how many dumb things really smart clinicians have said to my parents. Not all of them. There's some incredible clinicians and they're doing hard things and they're diagnosing sick kids and I have nothing but respect for them, but they say some really dumb things. And we have to change that. We have to remind ourselves that the speed of change is beyond our imagination right now. People just can't get their head wrapped around how quickly things are happening. And so none of us know what tomorrow holds. But if we don't work towards, it's like trust God, but row towards shore, right? We have to get to tomorrow. So we have to keep ourselves healthy as parents. We have to take care of our kids. And we have to believe good things are happening. We have to share our data. I mean, another thing we need to get over is this whole privacy obsession. I realize I'm going a little off the reservation here. But there's a lot of people running around worried about Google knowing what they're going to order tomorrow. Fine. If you're a rare disease parent, you might need to think harder about keeping your child's data 200% protected and recognize that there are strong systems like Citizen who can de-identify your data and keep it HIPAA compliant. But by sharing with Citizen and letting them share that anonymized data with researchers, you can accelerate science. And so the two things I'd like to change, or I want to change the words clinicians are using and genetic counselors, although they say dumb things less when they give diagnoses. And I want us to have an honest conversation with parents who are like, well, is this private? What about my child's privacy? I'm like, you can be private, alone, and untreated for your whole life. But if you want my son's genetic records, like, psh, I'll give them to anyone who wants to do research on this. Because until we share this child's information and their medical records and their clinical history, that's how you write a natural history study. And so I think, you know, we can protect privacy in a smart and sophisticated way so as to accelerate research. But if people who are just refuse to share or engage in studies or whatever, but then want to know why there isn't a therapy ready, that I don't think they're connecting the dots. And I think that we need to have a much more nuanced conversation with rare disease families about you've got to share the data. If you don't share the data, it's going to slow things down and our kids don't have time.
So I have a comment. Speaking of sharing, you know, we talked about a little bit about the importance of natural history data and having a data set by which you can compare a potential therapeutic. Building natural history of untreated patients is critical. What we see when we're in the fortunate position of having a potential therapeutic, or sometimes more than one potential therapeutic, is there will be multiple natural history studies that are funded by individual companies. And it's duplicative, and it's wasteful, and it's inefficient, and there's only so many patients. And there are rumblings in the last couple of years of companies who are developing a therapeutic for the same disease, so competitors, who agree to come together and find a way to potentially create a pool of shared natural history data. But that is something that is so important. And I can speak specifically to GM1 gangliosidosis, where there are multiple natural history studies that are ongoing. And it's if we could find a way to pull it, that would be so much better for the patients, and it would enable leveraging of one data set. You know, once industry starts getting involved, it's, you know, they're bringing the therapeutics, but it's part of a competitive industry, unfortunately. But I really think finding a way to be non-competitive on natural history should be a solution that's identifiable. Today it's not, but I think we're making progress.
Can I pile on?
Of course, please.
Just 2 points. Dawn's list was exactly right. I would add, these kids have been subjected to a lot of tests. So there's an ethical argument here, right? First of all, you're all developing data that can help everybody and you're siloing it for some modest competitive advantage. That's just dumb. Second of all, if you're doing a natural history study, like let's just think about this for a second. You're dragging kids who've spent way too much time in hospitals, had a lot of trauma in hospitals. You're sticking needles in kids who hate needles. You're sedating them. You're doing spinal taps. This is bananas. How can you justify? So like, number one, doing that more than you need to just is not right. It doesn't suggest that you as a company understand that patients are people and we should care about them. Number two, let's double click on inefficiency. This is why Citizen is my flagship. My foundation, I talk to new family on day one. Day two, I'm like, sign up for Citizen. Two things. Number one, Citizen, I'm not subjecting them to a single additional test. I'm harvesting their medical record and I'm pulling all existing results out. It's not a classic gold standard natural history study in one center, blah, blah, blah. But no one had to be subjected to additional testing or travel. Number two, that data resides under an IRB in Citizen who is in close partnership with SRF, and anyone and their mother who's a researcher can have it for free, and any company can license it for a hell of a lot less than it would cost them to do the study. So that, to my mind, is minimizing the impact on sick kids while maximizing the benefit to the corporate and academic community. And I'm not saying what we're doing is best. You know, there are people who want to do their own studies and look for their own things, fine. But let's not forget, you're subjecting sick kids to tests in places where they've already been traumatized. And that makes me nuts.
Let's leverage the data that has already been collected.
What she said.
And I'll echo that too, what you both said. Well, I want to thank you both for your time today. This has been great. It's been very educational for me. I hope that you found it worthwhile as well. And again, I appreciate you joining our conversation about rare disease.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes and how we can make it better, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorassi.com or contact us at our website at biorassi.com.